The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy, Joe and Teresa Graydon. Question. Well, is your medicine freezing in your mailbox? I experienced a problem with frozen medication. Combivent Respimat inhalation spray was shipped to me during an unusually cold spell. I noticed I was not getting the same relief from my breathing, and the relief I did get didn't last the expected 6 hours. I called Boehringer Ingelheim, the manufacturer. The representative I spoke to instructed me to stop using the inhaled meds immediately. They shipped me a replacement right away. Is it safe to get mail-order medicine in the winter? Answer. You raise a fascinating question. Most medicines are supposed to be maintained within a relatively narrow temperature range, 68 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit. For short periods of time, it is generally okay if temperature fluctuates between 59 and 86 degrees Fahrenheit. During either winter or summer, shipped medications may spend hours outside those parameters. One woman wrote, quote, "My husband was sent some Androgel by mail order, but we had to go out of town for a funeral at the last minute. The meds spent 8 days riding around in a truck before they could be delivered. Routine blood tests revealed that the meds were no good. The manufacturer was so concerned that it tracked down exactly where the drugs had been and at what temperatures. Apparently, they spent too much time in temps over 85 degrees, so the company refunded our money," unquote. Question. I've been taking duloxetine or Cymbalta for about 9 years for depression. When I first started taking it, I was told I would be better in a year and could stop taking it. Unfortunately, I found out the hard way that that isn't true. The side effects of trying to come off of it are horrific. Missing even a day causes nausea, headaches, and dizziness. When I've accidentally run out, I've landed in the hospital because I've been so ill. I really need to get off this medication, but I'm scared stiff at the thought of being so sick. Answer. Stopping almost any antidepressant suddenly can result in severe withdrawal symptoms. Many people report brain zaps, dizzy spells, nausea, headaches, sweating, and visual disturbances. This can be extremely debilitating. Gradual tapering over several months may reduce the discomfort. We provide more details and other approaches for supporting mental health in our guide to dealing with depression. Controlling blood sugar could benefit sex life. Question. I have read that high blood sugar can contribute to erectile dysfunction. My wife died more than 2 years ago, but I now have a lady friend. I want to be able to perform if called upon. Can you tell me about natural ways to reduce my blood sugar levels? I do use a lot of sugar in my morning coffee, and I drink more soda pop than water. Answer. Elevated blood sugar can affect blood vessels that are essential for erections, just as it affects blood vessels in other parts of the body. And that's cited in the Journal of Sexual Medicine, December 2015. So you are wise to look for ways to control your blood sugar. If you have been diagnosed with diabetes, we urge you to follow your doctor's advice and take the medications that have been prescribed. If, however, you are trying to keep your blood sugar down, though it isn't yet at the level of diabetes, there are several things you can do. You might want to experiment with stevia, S-T-E-V-I-A, instead of sugar to sweeten your morning coffee. Adding some cinnamon to the coffee grounds could also be helpful. Try to change the ratio of water to soft drinks. Sugar-sweetened beverages provide a lot of empty calories. To get blood sugar down, you want to reduce the amount of sugar and refined carbs in your diet. Exercise also is crucial for good blood sugar control. Certain herbs may be helpful. Bitter melon, fenugreek, or nopal cactus could help you maintain normal blood sugar. From the Wall Street Journal, a breakthrough stroke treatment can save lives if it's available. Access to a thrombectomy, which can forestall damage, depends where patients live. Minutes mattered to two Atlanta area residents who showed severe stroke symptoms last autumn. The right treatment done quickly can help prevent brain damage. An ambulance raced a 74-year-old man to a hospital nearby that wasn't an institution capable of offering the most advanced procedure. He arrived October 30th at 9:30 a.m. with right side weakness, unable to speak. Those symptoms should have been enough for personnel to immediately transfer him to Grady Memorial Hospital, says Raul G. Naguaria, Grady's chief of stroke endovascular therapy, who treated him and recounted the case. Grady can perform a procedure called thrombectomy that is gaining favor for its ability to preempt brain damage in many patients. Instead, the man got two scans. By the time a helicopter transferred him to Grady at around 2 p.m., a good outcome was nearly impossible, says Dr. Naguera. The patient is expected to have lifelong severe disabilities and not be able to care for himself. On November 1st, a 77-year-old woman was discovered on her bedroom floor with similar symptoms at 9:30 a.m. She arrived by ambulance directly at Grady and underwent a thrombectomy around noon, says Dr. Naguera, and is back to normal. The thrombectomy is beginning to transform stroke treatment. Using it, a doctor pulls clots from the brain. Leading stroke doctors concluded in a February 2016 analysis in the medical journal The Lancet that 2015 stroke studies showed 38 out of 100 patients treated with thrombectomy will have a less disabled outcome than with standard care, and that 20 or more will achieve functional independence. The procedure, says Denver area stroke specialist Dr. Donald F. Fry, has the same transformative effect on treating stroke as penicillin did for infections. The contrasting experiences among patients, such as the two in Atlanta area, show how far the U.S. medical establishment is from making thrombectomy standard practice, since it gained significant credibility from large clinical trials in 2014 and 15. A severe stroke victim must get a thrombectomy before damage sets in. For every minute with blood flow blocked, by many estimates, 2 million brain cells die. Ambulance crews protocols, though, often don't specify driving a severe stroke patient directly to a thrombectomy-capable hospital. Many stroke specialists say so a patient often lands first in a hospital that can't do the procedure. Delayed treatment. In those hospitals, some medical research shows there are often delays in getting patients who need a thrombectomy to the right hospital. Many patients with severe strokes aren't helped by conventional treatment with drugs, many stroke specialists say. And a thrombectomy isn't an option at all in many regions. Many hospitals don't offer them because it is hard to build thrombectomy teams of specialist doctors and assistants who can be on call 24 hours a day for the quick response such patients need. The procedure is new enough that there aren't enough specialists to hire, and doctors often must spend years learning it on the job. The U.S. system that creates low thrombectomy rates is almost at the point of being unethical, says stroke neurologist S. Claiborne Johnston, dean of the University of Texas Dell Medical School. Stroke experts estimate that, as a general rule, thrombectomy should be going to 20% or more of patients with clot-caused strokes. This subset of patients have large vessel occlusion, large clots in large vessels that often trigger the worst disabilities or death. Thrombectomies don't apply to a brain hemorrhage, another major type of stroke. Washington, D.C. metro area hospitals, including those in Virginia and Maryland suburbs, did thrombectomies in 2% of Medicare clot-caused stroke patients in the 12 months into June 30, 2017, the lowest rate among the 50 largest U.S. metro areas. Denver was the area with the highest rate, 9.3%. The Wall Street Journal determined those rates by merging population data with Medicare stroke and thrombectomy data compiled by Definitive Healthcare LLC, a medical data analysis company. Among all U.S. hospitals, the rate was 2.8%. Some hospitals do better. Atlanta's Grady gave thrombectomies to 28% of its clot-based Medicare stroke patients in the year ended June 30th. The University of Toledo gave them 20%, and Swedish Medical Center in Inglewood, Colorado, to 24% in the same period. Thrombectomies, which have been used in some hospitals for a decade, gained currency after the positive 2014 and 15 clinical trials. In the procedure, a doctor typically slides a catheter through an artery to the brain and grabs a clot, often with a relatively simple device called a stent retriever. A hospital must spend millions of dollars to gear up with special equipment and staff, but thrombectomies are well reimbursed by Medicare and insurers and ultimately are more profitable than a lower level of stroke treatment, says Tudor G. Joven, chief of the University of Pittsburgh's renowned Stroke Institute. Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, Washington, treats about 750 clot-based stroke patients annually, but doesn't do thrombectomies. Officials there say they are trying to build up a 24-hour-a-day thrombectomy capability. Until they do, they say, the regional ambulance service transports thrombectomy candidates an hour south to Seattle. The hospital's medical director for stroke, Dr. Tavinder Singh, says Providence has the equipment to do the thrombectomy and that he hopes to hire two specialists soon. There is debate over which stroke victims should go immediately to thrombectomy. Some hospitals that aren't capable of doing thrombectomies say they can first give an anti-clotting drug called TPA, and if that isn't enough, quickly transfer patients to a comprehensive center for a thrombectomy. Many stroke specialists say some hospitals that don't do thrombectomies resist a change in ambulance protocols because these allow the hospitals to admit more patients and hold on to them longer. Officials in non-thrombectomy hospitals say there isn't a financial motive for resisting protocol changes that may send patients elsewhere. They say it is optional to see a stroke patient as quickly as possible. They say it is optimal to see a stroke patient as quickly as possible and that they are capable of transferring patients in a timely fashion. Robert P. Holman, medical director of the District of Columbia Fire and Emergency Medical Services, agrees that the protocol in the capital often sends patients first to a non-thrombectomy hospital, but says patients can be transferred to a thrombectomy center quickly and arrive there with just a 20-minute drive. He defends the current system by saying it is very hard for our first responders to assess in the field a stroke severity. And it is hard to tell afterward if a given patient would have benefited from a timely thrombectomy because a stroke's impact is unpredictable. Dr. Nguera in Atlanta's Grady uses the metaphor of fighting a forest fire. Sometimes it stops the fire after a few trees burn. Other times, irreversible damage has already taken place. Even the conventional wisdom that all patients have only a short window of opportunity has been challenged. A study presented in Europe in 2017 showed some patients, even 24 hours after a stroke, can have a 73% lower risk of disability with a thrombectomy. The outcome largely depends on the patient's individual physiology, the researchers said. Protocol questions. Fewer than 20 states have ambulance protocols directing severe stroke patients to thrombectomy hospitals, according to the Society of Neurointerventional Surgery. In Washington, D.C., there is no requirement ambulances take severely stricken patients to the three hospitals capable of thrombectomies. Instead, a stroke patient often gets taken initially to a hospital designated as a primary stroke center. That designation is largely given to U.S. hospitals able to give the drug TPA, which usually won't dissolve the largest clots in large arteries. Most of these hospitals don't offer thrombectomies, often leading to delay for patients who need them, says Juliet Salcy, former medical director of DC Fire and EMS. Dr. Salcy quit in January 2016, she says, after unsuccessfully urging changes, including a revised stroke protocol in which paramedics would assess the severity of strokes in ambulances and speed more in for thrombectomies. Dr. Salcy says that in many cities, non-thrombectomy hospitals have resisted changing such protocols. They have a fundamental belief, which I don't agree with, that paramedics can't diagnose severe strokes, she says. We're not doing the right thing for patients. Dr. Holman, who succeeded her, says his department's protocol hasn't changed since Dr. Salcy's departure, but the department is trying to find ways for emergency personnel to screen patients and better decide whom to take directly to thrombectomy-ready hospitals. A 984-patient study published in September 2017 in the journal Circulation concluded inter-hospital transfer was associated with significant treatment delays and lower chance of good outcomes from a thrombectomy. Thrombectomy advocates say it has been demonstrated that paramedics can conduct simple measures to determine how severe a stroke is. Doctors from Barcelona wrote in the journal Stroke in December 2013 that they had created a scale that is a simple tool that can accurately assess stroke severity by emergency medicine technicians. Authorities in some U.S. cities, including Pittsburgh, have adopted the scale. Some U.S. regions have revamped their ambulance protocols to send stroke victims more quickly to thrombectomy hospitals, and many major hospitals have been gearing up procedures to get severe stroke victims quickly into the treatment. Among them is the University of Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Presbyterian Hospital. When a possible stroke patient arrives at the emergency room, a neurology team member is notified immediately. If it is the right kind of severe stroke, the patient goes in for a thrombectomy immediately. A stroke patient in the emergency department gets evaluated in a median of 22 minutes, down from 59 minutes in 2015, the hospital says. The UPMC's Dr. Jovan sometimes breaks into song and dance during the procedure. During a complex case last year involving five passes to remove clots, he sang clot access number five to the tune of love potion number nine. A thrombectomy's benefits can be striking. Walter Noble and Harold Butch Wright, next-door neighbors in Mesa, Arizona, suffered severe strokes a month apart. Mr. Wright on Christmas Day 2014, Mr. Noble in January 2015. They were taken to the closest hospital, Banner Baywood Medical Center. There, their fates diverge. Doctors noted Mr. Noble's right-sided weakness, says Mohammed Taleb, the doctor who later treated him. They did a CT scan and gave him the drug TPA. Mr. Noble, then 75, started fluctuating between being able and unable to talk. They transferred him quickly to Banner Desert Medical Center for a thrombectomy, Dr. Taleb says. The next morning, Mr. Noble was alert. He says he now lives a normal life. Mr. Wright had a stroke after 10 a.m., says his wife, Marianne Wright. He, too, got the drug, and his symptoms fluctuated, Dr. Taleb says. A neurologist was consulted at 3:57 p.m. Mr. Wright wasn't transferred to Banner Desert until 7 p.m., says Dr. Taleb, who did both thrombectomies. Dr. Taleb started Mr. Wright's thrombectomy at about 8:10 p.m. and found large amounts of tissue destroyed. Mr. Wright, 5 years younger than Mr. Noble, was sent to a hospice and died 2 days later, says Mrs. Wright. Dr. Taleb says the cases were mirror images. The difference between the neighbors, he says, was that Mr. Noble was transferred in a timely manner while the other patient was transferred at least 3 or 4 hours later. A spokeswoman for Banner Health, which includes both hospitals, says that at the time Medical literature did not clearly demonstrate that a thrombectomy was a benefit to patients suffering from an acute ischemic stroke, and that once new literature and guidelines emerged, Banner took a lead in the early identification of patients who were candidates for this treatment. Dr. Taleb says he and others are working toward a Phoenix area ambulance protocol to send severe stroke patients more directly to thrombectomy-ready hospitals. He estimates it will take 3 to 6 months before that happens. When it's not Alzheimer's, dementia's many forms. You jokingly refer to them as senior moments, forgetting where you put your car keys or finding yourself slow to recall an old friend's name. But deep down, you wonder if it's more than just getting older. You're worried these could be the first signs of Alzheimer's. For many people, minor forgetfulness is a sign of normal aging. With the passing years, your brain shrinks slightly due to a breakdown and loss of nerve cells. Thinking and memory may not be as sharp as they once were, and you may experience occasional memory lapses. These changes vary from person to person and are usually subtle. Most importantly, they don't interfere with your life. Certain medical conditions and medications also can cause reversible memory loss. What's not normal is severe memory loss and related symptoms that affect your day-to-day living, the hallmarks of dementia. Dementia can cause confusion, language difficulties, problems performing mentally demanding tasks, and mood or personality changes. While Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, accounting for 60-80% of dementia cases, it's not the only one. How memory loss progresses. Mild cognitive impairment, MCI, is often the first step in the decline from normal cognitive function to dementia. The primary symptom is memory loss that's noticeable to you and those around you. For example, difficulties remembering doctor appointments or recent conversations, but it's not enough to hinder your daily activities or prevent you from being independent. Up to 20% of adults 65 and older may have MCI. You're diagnosed with it, you have an increased risk of developing dementia. More than 30% of people who have MCI will progress to dementia within 5 years. However, many people who have MCI don't develop dementia, and the condition will remain stable or even improve. Sometimes memory loss is attributed to MCI when in fact it's being caused by treatable conditions such as side effects from certain medications such as opioids, antihistamines, antidepressants, and urinary incontinence, physical inactivity, social isolation, alcohol consumption, depression, thyroid disease, hypothyroidism, vitamin B12 deficiency, high or low blood sugar, dehydration and constipation, vision or hearing loss, sleep disturbances such as obstructive sleep apnea or insomnia, accumulation of fluid in the brain, normal pressure, hydrocephalus, infections including HIV, syphilis, urinary tract infections, and infections involving the brain. Delving into dementia, there are several different types of dementia. While each has distinct characteristics, many have overlapping symptoms. More than one type is often present. Types include Alzheimer's disease. Early symptoms include depression and problems remembering recent events, with time worsening communication skills, poor judgment, confusion, behavioral changes, and problems with basic functions such as hygiene occur. Next, vascular dementia. While similar to Alzheimer's, the first signs of this dementia are often poor judgment and impairment of decision-making and organizational skills. Vascular dementia occurs after a large stroke or a series of several smaller strokes that sometimes go unnoticed. Compared with Alzheimer's, physical disability tends to be worse and memory loss is milder. Dementia with Lewy bodies. This form also causes memory loss, but often surfaces early on in the form of sleep problems, hallucinations, and movement issues, such as slow or unbalanced walk. This is closely related to Parkinson's dementia, which occurs in people with Parkinson's disease. Frontal temporal lobar degeneration. This includes several forms of dementia that cause personality or behavioral problems and language difficulties. Memory is usually not affected in the early stages of this disease. No single test can diagnose dementia. Only a comprehensive medical evaluation can determine whether memory changes are the result of the aging process, medical conditions, and medications, MCI, or a form of dementia. Preventing dementia. More than a third of dementia cases could potentially be prevented by addressing several key risk factors, including diabetes, hypertension, and obesity, taking your diabetes medication as prescribed, controlling high blood pressure, and consuming a healthy diet may help you lose any excess weight and improve your cardiovascular health, thus potentially reducing your dementia risk. Inactivity. Exercise can help increase blood flow to the brain, reduce the loss of brain cells, and improve cardiovascular-related dementia risk factors. Smoking. Smoking has been linked to a 41% increased risk of dementia. And finally, depression and social isolation. Some research suggests that depression can negatively impact stress hormones and alter brain structure. Being socially isolated can also be a risk factor for dementia. If you have depression, your doctor may recommend therapy or medication. Tick bite causes meat allergy. We'll talk about that next time. Speeding recovery from major surgery with eating. Regaining bowel function, as indicated by an initial passing of gas, is an important milestone in recovery from major abdominal surgical procedures. In most cases, the faster you progress toward eating normal food after major surgery, the better your recovery. At Mayo Clinic and many other medical centers, steps are taken to get people back to eating quickly. These include use of minimally invasive surgical techniques when appropriate, good management of pain, nausea, and vomiting, and limiting use of opioid pain medications. People who have colon surgery typically eat dinner the night of the procedure. Not every major surgical procedure involves a quick return to eating. Up to 20% of people may not tolerate early nutrition by mouth after major surgery. In these people, some studies have suggested that gum chewing may help speed the return of bowel function because it stimulates many of the same digestive functions as eating. Although Mayo's surgical protocols don't include gum chewing as a recommendation, Mayo doctors say doing so periodically after surgery doesn't cause harm in most cases and may be a pleasant distraction with a possible recovery improving benefit. And this was all from the Mayo Clinic health letter. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.